is 98-0715, State X Rel Ira Lee Anderson L. versus Marianne Cook. Representing Mr. Anderson L. is Donald Romanson. Mr. Romanson, we appreciate your taking of this case in the appellate section of the State Bar.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Don Romanson. I represent Petitioner Ira Anderson. This case involves two inmate discipline hearings. It's undisputed that the Department of Corrections erred by failing to provide notice of the hearings to Mr. Anderson. The issue is whether the agency lost competency to proceed or whether the error was waived as a matter of law. It's our position in this case that a notice of hearing is a threshold jurisdictional type issue that has to be satisfied before an agency has the power to act. It's a basic, a fundamental, and a mandatory right. It's not a technical error. It's not an unimportant right. If this was an unimportant right, then the question becomes, why did the Department of Corrections enact an unimportant rule? Furthermore, because the Department wrote these rules themselves, if it's unimportant, they can repeal it.
Mr. Lumetson, let me ask you, counsel, at the outset, and I was looking in the first notice. Now, in both hearings, your client received the notice under 30376. That's the, just notifying him of the major disciplinary hearing rights. And I noticed in that first notice, and it's agreed you did not get the second notice in either hearing, that this is on Appendix 125 in your appendix. Question or number 7, it says that we're talking about notice and whether he knew that he should get another notice. It says the hearing officer or designee will notify you and your staff advocate of the date, time, and place of the hearing. And then it seems that he would be aware of the fact that he was entitled to another notice if he had read this.
That's correct, Your Honor. Right.
So one has to assume, and in this case, we noted that, as Chief Justice indicated, that this was a pro se case and that you have come on board now, but Mr. Anderson, apparently was aware of the fact that he would receive notice. So he had some knowledge of that.
That's correct. The 303.76 right. Notice, which essentially is a notice of the charges, if we could make an analogy to criminal law, tells the inmate several things. First of all, it attaches a conduct report and says these are the charges that you've been charged with. It also says you have been charged with a major offense, which entitles you to a formal due process hearing. Then it says you may waive those rights, but you have to do it knowingly and intelligently. Then it says you will be given a second notice, essentially.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
Within 2 to 21 days, you must have a hearing. That's true. Right. The problem is, see, there's other rules, too. 30381 sub 7 also says that you will be notified of who your witnesses are before you are issued the second notice. And 30376 says you will be given a second notice. Now, the inmate relies on those statements, and he wasn't given a second notice in this case. His witnesses were not approved before the second notice was issued. They were approved at the hearing. So this inmate, and by the way, this inmate was in a segregated unit. He was taken directly from that unit to the hearing with no notice whatsoever. So this inmate not only is in a context of a prison where he's isolated and disoriented, but then he's dragged right from a segregation unit with no opportunity to prepare for that hearing.
Counsel, can I just ask you that last statement about he was in segregation and he had no advance? That is in the record?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
In fact, while we're at
I know that was in your brief, and I just wanted to make sure that that was how it actually happened.
Right, and that's undisputed. In one of the documents in the appendix, it indicates that he was in TLU, which is temporary lockup, which is the same as a segregation unit. I think they call it Unit 14, and there's also a document that indicates he's in Unit 14. There's no dispute about that. In fact, this inmate was taken He never talked to his witnesses before this hearing. He never talked to his staff advocate about the merits of this case before this hearing. They came to him first thing in the morning at 9 o'clock in the morning and took him right to the hearing with no notice. He didn't even have the opportunity to organize his thoughts before he went to that hearing. Now, this second notice is the essence of a fair hearing. If an agency tells an inmate that he has the right to a second notice and that he has a right to have his witnesses approved before they issue that second notice, and by the way, that second notice is by rule necessarily signed by the hearing officer, so that's a third error that the Department of Corrections made in this case. He is entitled to those, and he's also entitled to a meaningful opportunity to prepare a defense.
What must the second notice contain, according to their own rules?
Well, according to 303.76, it says you will be notified of the date, time, and place of the hearing. Okay, that's in 303.76.
And now, that's what's different from the first one. The first one does not give date, time, and place.
No, the first notice is really a notice that notifies you that you have the right to a formal due process hearing, that you have the right to waive that hearing, and that you will be notified of the date, time, and location of that hearing. Now, the other administrative rules tell you that your witnesses have to be approved before you get that second notice. So this inmate is sitting in segregation thinking, I'm going to get a second notice. Before that happens, they're going to approve or disapprove of my witnesses. And none of those things happen. He's just pulled from segregation, disoriented, isolated, right to a hearing. He's never had a chance to even talk to his witnesses or his advocate.
We have a copy of the form that is typically used for this second notice in the record here.
I put it in my appendix.
Is that this one, this notification of disciplinary hearing?
It's
at appendix 132. Is that the form
that's
usually used?
Okay. Yes. Now, I put that in there because that signifies the Department of Corrections has a form, although they never used it.
They never used it in this case.
They never used it in this case, and apparently not in this institution. They didn't use it in the Bergman case, and they didn't use it in any of the proceedings involving Anderson. So the fact is that this form did exist, and I believe it existed prior to the Bergman case, the facts in Bergman. But it certainly existed before the allegations of misconduct in this case. And yet, apparently, they either did not know they had the form or they didn't hear the court's pronouncement in Bergman that it's a requirement, a mandatory requirement, that they give the inmate a second notice, which is actually the first notice because it is the notice of the date, time, and location of the hearing.
So where did you find this form? If the institutions aren't using it, does this just exist in some central repository in Madison?
I found it by researching the forms in the department.
But we don't know how widespread this form is or isn't used, apparently, within the adult institutions.
Well, that's not in the record, but I think you can glean from the record that the department doesn't believe that it needs to use that form. The department hasn't heard Bergman. The department still is arguing that it's not necessary to even give that second notice, although in this court they have conceded that the second notice is a mandatory and required notice. But in the earlier courts, Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals, I believe the department argued that it wasn't even necessary to give this form.
What's the date on that notice? Usually on that form, I just can't read it because it's been blanked out.
I can't read it myself, Your Honor. My remembrance is that it is early 90s or late 80s. I can't say that for sure, but that's my remembrance.
You indicated earlier that if they don't want to use it, they should just repeal it. If they repeal this, counsel, would there be any constitutional problems?
Well, there may be, but that's for the department to examine if they wish to repeal it. There may be due process concerns. That's not involved. That's not an issue in this case. They would have to broach it. If they want to push the boundaries of due process, they can do that. But the fact of the matter is that they wrote these rules. They're obligations that the department placed upon themselves. If they think they're unnecessary and important, they should either revise them or repeal them. That's what Judge Snyder said in the Court of Appeals. And that's true. They don't have to go back to the legislature and ask the legislature to revise or repeal them. These are their own rules. And that's what's important about this case. When an agency drafts and promulgates its own rules, they're held to follow them. That's what the Jones and Riley case say. They say that the rules prescribe the boundaries of their authority. When they abandon those rules, they exceed their authority. When they exceed their authority, they lose the competency to proceed. That's clear. If they don't like their own rules, then they can change them. But to come into this court and say that these rules are unnecessary and important is unpersuasive. These are the notice of a hearing is essential to the opportunity for a fair and meaningful hearing. It's a central, and that's another thing that we should discuss. The department or the state is saying that the failure to follow rules doesn't necessarily result in a loss of competency. And they cite the Bolig case and the Kaiwanda case. Now, first of all, those aren't cases that involve an agency enacting its own rules. But even in those cases, they talk about whether the whether it's a central right or whether it's a technical error. Now, in this case, we have Bergman, which tells us that this is a basic, fundamental, and mandatory right. This is not a technical error. There's just no way you can conclude that a notice of hearing is a technical error. This is the essence of a fair hearing. Notice. And these facts exemplify why this is such a basic and fundamental right. This man was, he had no opportunity to talk to anyone before his hearing. He's taken from a segregation cell, one of these instances, directly to a hearing. The only evidence that's relied upon by the hearing officer was the written statement of the accuser, who was not even present at the hearing. Furthermore, the advocate who was appointed by the prison never raised these objections. So you have rules which require the staff advocate who is employed by the prison to raise any defense, that's what it says, assist the inmate in preparing and presenting any defense. And the rules, I think it's 30387, I believe, or 78, I think it is, 30378, talk about the training that an advocate's supposed to have. Training in any defenses. And yet, this advocate doesn't even raise the failure of giving the second notice of the hearing. So, you know, what we end up with is a situation where the department is not held accountable for following its own rules. And when you look at the purpose that the department has written in the form of an appendix, which I put in the white appendix at page 143, the department itself indicates that the objective of these discipline rules is to increase fairness, increase equality of treatment, increase the possibility of rehabilitation, and increase respect for the system. Now, how will an inmate have respect for a system if the Department of Corrections isn't obligated to follow its own rules and is allowed to, in fact, have disrespect for its own rules in numerous ways? I mean, this isn't just a failure of notice of hearing. It's a failure to approve witnesses before the hearing, which by the way, takes on a judicial aspect, because this hearing officer, what the hearing officer is doing, in essence, is telling this inmate who can support or defend against the charges. Now, the same hearing officer is supposed to issue the notice. None of this happened.
Well, Mr. Robinson, first, let's just accept that there's been the non-adherence to the rules.
That's undisputed.
Then the question comes that the inmate here has knowledge of the rules. Either you can use the general rubric that everybody is held to know the rule, the law, or you can take the position that your client was advised of the rules specifically in that first notice that the client got. And so then your client goes to this hearing, and your client could have said, I'm not going, right? As a matter of fact, the notice that God says, if you don't want to go, we're going to proceed without you, right? So that was a choice. Then when he got there, he could have said, you violated my rights by not following your rules. Right? He didn't.
He could have.
And he proceeded with this hearing knowing, or at least we can say constructively knowing, that they weren't following the rules. So if you had done that in a proceeding, the court would have said, Mr. Robinson, you waived these rules for your client. Tough luck on your client.
Well, there are several problems with that analysis, Your Honor. First of all, with a jurisdictional type issue, a threshold type issue, waiver is irrelevant. See, when you have a hearing and there's no notice, the hearing no longer has validity. It loses the force of law. The agency loses the competency to proceed. You can't have a waiver or a harmless error analysis. They're irrelevant. Those waiver presumes jurisdiction or competency to proceed. If you don't have, if the hearing itself lacks authority and has no validity, then you can't analyze waiver. And that's what the court said in that's what Chief Justice Heffernan said in BJN. That's what the court said in Jones. In several other cases, if you have an issue where the court loses jurisdiction, essentially, or competency to proceed, there is no longer the force of law to that hearing. And waiver just can't be analyzed. Neither can harmless error.
Yeah, now that's what the state argues about waiver, and that's why I asked you the question in 30376 with the notice. Had he, assuming he read that, he knew he had notice, so the argument of the state seems to be, well, he laid in the weeds, so to speak. He went through these hearings, and then he raised this on cert to the circuit court, and he could have raised this not only at his first hearing, but the appeal hearing that he had in front of the warden. So that's the argument why, in this case, because he was aware, at least, that there was a notice, this was a second notice, that he waived his argument. He did not exhaust his administrative remedies.
Well, the problem with that argument is, first of all, it's basically a harmless error argument. They're saying that the department or the state is saying that Anderson, the error was rectified because he appeared at his hearing and didn't object, those types of things. The problem with that argument is that he doesn't have an obligation to raise anything. This is the Department of Corrections' duty to follow its rules. And it's like Judge Snyder said, you have the choice of either following your rules or repealing the rules if they're unnecessary. But if you don't repeal them and the rules are in effect, you have to follow them or you lose your jurisdiction in a threshold type issue like this. This is a simple jurisdictional type issue that in fact, Chief Justice Heffernan in the BJN case said that this is clear, this is like subject matter jurisdiction issue you learn in first year law school. You cannot waive subject matter jurisdiction. You can bring up subject matter jurisdiction at any time. And that's what I analyzed or analogized this to. It's a competency to proceed issue that you cannot waive. You can bring it up any time. Furthermore, Anderson didn't realize, he said, at the circuit court level, he didn't realize that he was entitled to a written notice of hearing until Bergman was issued. The Bergman decision came out after his alleged misconduct. But the state was aware of this obligation because they wrote the rule. Furthermore, they lost at every level in Bergman, so they knew that they had an obligation to follow these rules. And Bergman itself says that this is a required and mandatory procedure. It's a mandatory procedure. There's no discretion. Now, the state also argues that there should be flexibility. You know, the court should allow waiver because there has to be flexibility in the prison system. You know, that the needs of the prison have to be balanced against the rights to present witnesses or things like that. But this isn't an issue involving witnesses. The witnesses were all approved. Furthermore, it's not an issue of balancing. We're not balancing the rights of the needs of the prison against anything. This is a mandatory obligation of the states. There's no discretion.
How different is that than is it Sands, S-A-E-N-Z case? The Court of Appeals relied on that case and said, look, that case and this case both involve fundamental rights, and that if he can waive it in the Sands case, if that fundamental right can be waived in the Sands case, it certainly follows that there can be waiver in this case. How do you respond to that?
The problem with that argument is that if all fundamental rights are identical for purposes of waiver, then you can waive subject matter jurisdiction. Or you can waive the time limits for proceedings. You cannot waive subject matter jurisdiction. That's as clear can be. That's as old as precedent itself. And yet, under the Court of Appeals analysis, all fundamental errors are identical for purposes of a waiver. You could waive subject matter jurisdiction. So that can't be the rule. That just can't be the rule. Now, Sains, first of all, wasn't a threshold jurisdictional type case. That case was jurisdiction had already attached. That was a hearing level issue involving whether witnesses were necessary. That has nothing to do with jurisdiction. Furthermore, this court in Bergman was aware of the Sains case. Sains was issued in 1991. Bergman was issued in 1997, just a couple years ago. The state, and I went back and pulled the state's briefs from Bergman because they were saying that a waiver wasn't an issue in Bergman. And that's what the Court of Appeals said. Bergman wasn't a waiver case, and this case goes beyond Bergman. But at page 147 of my appendix, the last page of the appendix, I reproduced the state's brief. They argue waiver, and then they cite this court's opinion in Sains as support for that. It's the last page of this white appendix. So Bergman implicitly decided waiver. In fact, it did it in exactly the right way. What Bergman said was, Bergman said three things. The Department of Corrections wrote these rules themselves. It said, these are basic and mandatory rights. And it said, finally, the failure of the department to follow its own rules and give a basic procedural right such as notice invalidates the proceedings. And the court said, our inquiry ends here. And that's exactly right. The court's inquiry ended with the loss of competency to proceed. Waiver simply is irrelevant at that point. The court has no authority to proceed further. It's acting beyond its authority. That's one of the few issues that comes up on certiorari. Did the court exceed its jurisdiction? And in that analysis, what the cases say is a very important aspect of that issue is did the agency follow its own rules? Did the agency comply with the purposes of the rules? Now, in this case, the purposes of the rules are increased fairness, increased equality of treatment, increased the possibility of rehabilitation, and increased respect for the system. This court's decision has to start with that framework. I guess the question is, what remedy will increase fairness, increase equality of treatment, and increase respect for the system? Will a case resulting in waiver increase respect for the system under these facts? Will taking a person from segregation directly to a hearing when he hasn't talked to his witnesses or his staff advocate, and his staff advocate doesn't even raise these issues, which the states say are so unimportant, does that increase fairness? That's what this court has to decide. What will increase fairness, equality, and respect for the system consistent with the purposes and objectives of these rules that the department itself has written and attached as an appendix directly following the administrative code rules? You know, they quote Kenneth Culp Davis in their appendix. They talk about how the system will only get the respect it deserves if it is fair. They talk about how it's necessary to rehabilitate these inmates. They've demonstrated an inability to live by norms. They say that norms will only be followed if they are fair. I mean, they go on and on and on in a philosophical manifesto, almost, talking about how we have to not only try to decrease discretion and ad hoc judgments. See, in the inmate situation, what they're trying to do is eliminate ad hoc discretion by line officers. So they write these rules. They're saying these rules, although there's still some discretion left, for instance, you know, they have to decide whether they can bring a witness in that's dangerous. There's some discretion in that. there's some discretion in certain areas. They have to balance the needs of the prison against the rights of the inmate in some ways. And then there's also mandatory rights. There's certain instances where there's just no discretion.
And counsel, could we decide this case on waiver alone, but not the waiver you're talking about, and say that none of Mr. Anderson's actions constituted a waiver? I think that's a little bit different argument than you're making, right?
Right. I think the court could. I think in order to do that, the court would have to conclude that waiver applies. But that's another aspect of waiver. Not
so
only
you don't think it would be appropriate for us to decide it on those grounds?
Absolutely not. Waiver, first of all, the department wants waiver as a matter of law. Mm-hmm. But as if the court would analyze this as a matter of fact, I guess I would take the righteously indignant position that this cannot be waiver. How can a man waive something when he didn't get the notice that Bergman says is required? Never talked to his witnesses. What the state is essentially doing in this case is saying, we don't have to file a notice. If the court holds waiver, then when will the state ever give a notice? I mean, the state wants it both ways. They can't lose. If the man appears and objects, then they simply adjourn it. If the man appears and doesn't object, then he's waived it. What incentive does the state have to ever issue a notice under those circumstances? Furthermore, waiver would be inconsistent with the state's own forms. For instance, the 30376 form, which Justice Wilcox brought up, that form allows waiver, but it has to be knowing and intelligent. The inmate has to be told what he's waiving, the consequences of what he's waiving. He has to sign it, and it has to be approved by the security director. If this court concludes that there's waiver, then that's inconsistent with the department's own forms. So how could that be increasing equality of treatment? What we're saying essentially is you can waive all these rights in 30376 and other forms, but not this one. So what's an inmate supposed to think? How is he supposed to have respect for the system when the department on a day-to-day basis is saying if you waive these rights, they have to be knowing and intelligent, but when the state gets to court on an appeal, they say, no, you should be deemed to have waived these rights as a matter of law. Without any consideration of knowing, intelligent, or any other fact question, which would normally be a matter for a fact finder, not as a matter of law.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson. We'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Carla Kekaber, is that how you pronounce the name? Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, representing Marianne Cook.
May it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Carla Kekaber, and I represent the respondent appellant Marianne Cook, warden of the Kettle Moraine Correctional Institution. The Court of Appeals should be affirmed for two reasons. First, failure to provide a second notice of hearing did not deprive the disciplinary committee of competency to proceed. Second, Mr. Anderson waived any objection to the procedural error by not raising the issue before the disciplinary committee or in his appeal to the warden. This case is about fairness and flexibility. It is about providing inmates a fair and meaningful opportunity to present their defense at the prison disciplinary proceedings, but it is also about affording prison officials some flexibility in administering those proceedings. Failure to comply with a procedural directive does not always result in a loss of competency. If the purpose of the rule can be fulfilled without strictly complying with the procedural rule, the tribunal does not lose competency to proceed. So the first thing that you have to do is look at the purpose of the rule in question. In this case, 303.81 pertains to an inmate's right to present witnesses. According to the appendix note to that rule, the purpose is to balance the inmate's right to present witnesses against the department's interest in avoiding disruption and interference with the swift administration of justice. The notice section of that provision requires that the hearing officer give notice to the inmate, the advocate, the committee members, and the witnesses. And the purpose of that notice is to ensure that all the witnesses requested by the inmate are actually present at the hearing. In contrast, notice under 303.76 sub 3 notifies the inmate of the charges and gives the inmate notice of his procedural due process rights under Wolf versus McDonald. So the purpose of this first notice is to give the inmate an adequate time to prepare for the hearing. As further evidence of this point, the first notice has a time restriction. It must be given to the inmate within 2 days of its approval, whereas the second notice has no time restriction.
Let me ask you, and I ask the opposing counsel, about the language you just referred to in 30376. I was looking at on Appendix 132 that of opposing counsel's brief. This is his. We talked about the notification of disciplinary hearing. In the sense of competency, we know, we assume that Mr. Anderson read 30376 in this. If he read it, he knew he was going to get another notice. And he did not get that notice, and therefore, as opposing counsel indicated, at one time at least, and I don't believe that this was argued by you, that he was in segregation. He didn't have this notice, so his witnesses, his advocate, were not prepared. They weren't aware that they would have to appear, even though they did, but there was no time for preparation, no time for thought. What about that? How does that allow him, namely Mr. Anderson, any fairness under that scenario that I just pointed out?
Well, the first point is that Mr. Anderson did receive the first notice of hearing,
yes,
which is the notice that puts him on notice that there's going to be a hearing and that he has between 2 and 21 days from now he's going to be getting a hearing. So that's the notice. The purpose of that notice is to give him adequate time to prepare.
And to talk to his witnesses and others, is that your
point? Correct. Correct. And I think the record in this case shows that he did have some preparation time, because for the conduct report that you're referring to, where he was put in temporary lockup prior to the hearing, he had his own written statement, he had statements of another inmate, he had questions and answers from the sergeant who wrote the conduct report and from the shift supervisor.
Counsel, I understood your position to be, though, you're conceding that under Bergman, it was required that he receive the second notice.
That's correct.
So isn't the issue whether or not the second notice, the first notice is enough, a non-issue in this case, unless we want to overrule Bergman?
Well, I think the second notice, it's important to keep in mind the purpose of that notice, which is to make sure that everybody is at the hearing. Whereas
I'm not making myself clear. You are conceding, I understand, that under Bergman, the second notice must be given, and that the first notice isn't sufficient to fulfill the requirement of the giving of the second notice. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
You're conceding that?
Yes.
But let me just read you from Bergman. We conclude that WIS Admin Code dot 303.76 and 303.81 require that an inmate be given 2 written notices of a hearing to adjudicate an allegation of a major conduct violation. Those are the provisions applicable to this case?
Yes.
Because Bergman was not given the second written notice, we affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals. The prison disciplinary findings are vacated. Why shouldn't that apply in this case?
Well, I think Bergman can be distinguished on its facts. Bergman was essentially a competency case, although this court didn't refer to it as competency analysis. It was applied similar reasoning. The court concluded that second written notice under 303.81 sub 9 was a mandatory procedural requirement, that the defect was never rectified, and therefore the hearing was invalidated. This court didn't address what would have rectified the procedural defect, but because Mr. Bergman didn't attend the hearing, the purpose of the rule couldn't have been fulfilled as it was in the present case.
So the difference between this case and Bergman is, in this case, the prisoner showed up.
The prisoner showed up, presented his defense with his witnesses.
Okay. So that's the major difference. So Bergman, you're saying, only applies, that is, the second notice is only important and only significant when the prisoner doesn't show up.
No, I think the second notice serves several purposes.
I know, but what's the difference between Bergman in this case? The only difference is, in this case, he came and he made a defense. In Bergman, he didn't come.
Well, I think in Bergman, under the competency analysis, the purpose of the rule wasn't fulfilled.
Bergman doesn't say one word about competency.
It doesn't specifically use the competency word.
It just says, if you don't do it, you're out.
Correct. I think this also gets into the waiver issue.
Well, let's stay on this issue.
So, Bergman doesn't ever use competency. Bergman says, look, this is a rule, this was violated, and in effect, it's a rule, the violation of which will vacate the proceeding. Now, you can call it subject matter jurisdiction, you can call it competency, you can call it due process, you can call it there's a regulation, the state has to obey it, and what the remedy is always an issue when there's disobedience to a rule, and the remedy in Bergman was vacated. The only difference I can see between this and Bergman is that the prisoner showed up. So now, showed up and did not say, you didn't give me a waiver, you didn't give me notice, and then proceeded on. Now suppose he showed up and he just was silent, and he says, I don't want to continue. Would that be a Bergman case, or would that be an Anderson case?
I think that if he showed up and gave a reason why he didn't want to continue.
No, he just says, I'm not doing it.
Well, I think in Bergman, although the opinion didn't say this, Mr. Bergman had some concerns because he asked the court to, or he asked the disciplinary committee to hold the hearing on a specific date because he was waiting for a witness statement. So if the purpose of the second notice of hearing is to ensure that all the witnesses that the inmate requests are at the hearing, which is what the appendix note says, presumably this witness wasn't going to be there because Mr. Anderson didn't have time to notify this witness, or Mr. Bergman didn't have time to notify this witness.
So you're just not accepting the Bergman rule. If you don't get the second notice, the state's out. You really are trying to read Bergman read it more narrowly and say, well, let's look at other things.
That's correct. I think you need to analyze the purpose of the rule. If you're going to say that this second notice has some kind of quasi-jurisdictional qualities, you certainly have to look at the purpose of the rule in question and do a competency-type analysis.
Well, this second notice, let's just look at the appendix, that's at 132. First of all, is this an actual Department of Corrections form?
Yes, it is.
Do you know the date of it?
No, I'm afraid I do not.
Is it used? I mean, this is our fourth case, I think.
It's my understanding that it's
two proceedings in this case, and then we've had two other cases where this notice was not given.
It's my understanding that it is used. I don't know how widespread the practice is if they use it every single time. I think there are probably some balancing issues where they don't use it in certain
situations.
What's the
balance? I don't understand that. Now, we had in Bergman, and it's in the opinion, that the department appeared to want in Bergman that we revise language in Irby, which said, listen, you've got to tell them what time of the day, and you've got to repeat the charge. And the court said in Bergman that that's not the issue here, and we're not going to go back and look at Irby or further construe the degree and specificity required by the regulation. And that the department wanted a little leeway to say whether it was going to be 1 or 3 or 9, et cetera. And, of course, since the department has full control over this prisoner, the exact time of the day shouldn't make any difference to either one of them, assuming that they know what day it is and their witnesses know. But what's the problem here? And if there's a problem, you've had since Sens and Bergman to change this rule.
and yet the department seems to just not be willing to comply with it.
Well, I think the rule is still, the rule that there should be a second written notice is still a good rule, because there are certain situations, since the purpose of the rule is to make sure that everybody who's supposed to be at the hearing is there,
right.
That includes the staff, the employees, the DOC employees who wrote the conduct report. So there may be some scheduling difficulties. There may be some situations where it isn't notice from the hearing officer directly down to the unit saying, I need these three inmates up at the adjustment unit at 9 o'clock tomorrow, where that's not going to fulfill the purpose of the rule. If there are witnesses or DOC employees that are not going to be able to get that notice unless it's a written notice.
Okay, that's right. So why don't they give it?
Well, I think that in this situation, if the purpose of the rule is fulfilled, and if they're balancing, I mean, the appendix note to the rule specifically says that you have to balance DOC's interest in avoiding disruption and interference with swift punishment with the inmate's right to present witnesses.
Well, your opposing counsel argued basically just some normal pattern. What expectations, you know, when you're treating in Kettle Marine, I don't know how big it is, you have 500, 1,000 people there, that when you have these incidents, that there would be a reasonable expectation that everyone would be treated similar. And you talk about respect for the system. And it would seem that, and I wrote Irby, as I recall, and then we had Bergman, which was a 7-0 decision just in 97, and now we're back here again, that if the department feels that this, quote, second notice is something that is or could possibly be disruptive, they could just get rid of it. But it still exists, and as long as it still exists, there would be a reasonable expectation that it would be used. And the answer we're getting here, well, sometimes they use it, sometimes they don't, and the reason they might not use it is because it may be disruptive, or it may be that a particular witness has a vacation plan. I'm just making this up now, or that a particular witness may be in segregation. I mean, I don't know all of the norms of how the prison is run, but the point being that to have some expectation of a similarity of how things are handled, it should either be used or not used. What is your response? It's just that it's sort of helter-skelter, catch-as-can type of when we may or may not use it. And that I think that's what's bothering, at least it's bothering me, is how it is used. And it does not seem to be fair and reasonable that you would have someone who wanted to talk to the witnesses, or may have, but wants to prepare his or her case, because it applies to all prisons, that you would, you know, I can understand if there was a melee or something, but there doesn't seem to be anything other than the normal situation where someone violated the rules. It was a major disciplinary thing, and then they would be receiving this notification of disciplinary hearing. So my question is, why shouldn't there be an expectation of normalcy in using this particular form here, 151?
Well, I think the points that you were raising specifically pertain to the...
I wasn't trying to make the argument. I mean, that's what is bothering.
Well, I think that some of your concerns relate back to the inmate's preparation time and not having time to prepare witnesses. And according to the appendix note to the rules, it's 303.76 sub 3, the first notice that notifies the inmate of the charges and of his due process rights. So it's at that point, after he receives that notice, that he should begin preparing witnesses and should begin talking to his advocate and preparing for this hearing. And he knows that it's going to be occurring sometime between 2 and 21 days. And Wolf only requires 24 hours for the inmate to prepare. So our rule gives 303.76 of 3 gives the inmate 2 days, so a little bit more time to prepare. And I don't think that notice of the specific time, especially when that rule, the purpose of that rule is specifically to get everybody at the hearing who's supposed to be there. I don't think that in any way prejudices the inmate's right to present his defense. And counsel,
regardless of whether or not there's a due process right to the knowing the time and date of a general due process right, knowing the time and date of the hearing, doesn't 30376 by rule recognize a right that the inmate is to know the time and date of the hearing?
Well, I think you bring up a good distinction, the distinction between procedural rights, state-created procedural rights, and due process, federally protected due process rights. In Bergman, this court didn't address whether 303.81 sub 9 was required for due process. It simply said that it was a procedural rule. I think that under the competency analysis, once you determine that the purpose of the rule is fulfilled, that's when you go through the harmless error analysis.
Well, doesn't 303.76 recognize a right that the inmate has to know the time and date of the hearing?
It recognizes a procedural, a state-created procedural right under the administrative code.
Before you can, it seems to me, boilerplate law, before you can have waiver, there must be a knowing and intelligent waiver of a recognized right. So we have a recognized right by rule. Where in the record do you find the knowing and intelligent waiver of that recognized right?
Well, I think in Sens, this court concluded that waiver was effective even if it wasn't knowing and recognized or involuntary and intelligent.
Well, then, we better address Sens. That's what it said. I mean, is it your understanding of boilerplate waiver law that in order for a waiver to be valid, it must be knowing and intelligent?
I think in some situations that's true. Certainly not in administrative proceedings. And
you're right. Let me rephrase the question. In order for there to be a valid waiver of a recognized... The waiver has to be knowing and intelligent. Is that your understanding of boilerplate law?
Well, under the dissent in Sens, the dissent said that discussed this knowing and voluntary waiver. The majority in Sens said that the waiver did not have to be knowing and voluntary, but the dissent seemed to suggest that it needed to be a knowing and voluntary waiver.
Is it your position as an advocate for the state that when a recognized right exists, it can be waived even though it's an unintelligent and unknowing waiver, that there can be an unintelligent and unknowing waiver of a recognized right? Is that your position?
Yes, that is my position. So this brings me to my waiver argument. I think this case is analogous to Sens versus Murphy. In both cases, the department failed to comply with a mandatory procedural regulation. In
Before you continue on with the... I have a couple questions on waiver. I look at the page 7 and 8 of the red brief, your opponent's brief, and there is the form, waiver of formal due process major hearing, and this is a major hearing, is that correct?
Yes.
And I note that before there is a valid waiver, there has to be a signature by the defendant, and it has to be dated. Likewise, it has to be also a signature of a witness, and it has to be dated. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And your rules in Appendix 144 with regard to waivers say that to ensure that a waiver is a knowing, intelligent one, this is the department's rules, Appendix 144, to ensure that any waiver is a knowing, intelligent one, the inmate must be informed of his or her right to a due process hearing and what that entails. Be informed of what the hearing will be like if she or she waives due process, and be informed that the waiver must be in writing. And above that, subsection 2 says, waiver includes waiving the right to question or confront witnesses, and goes on to indicate what waiver includes. So in your rules indicate that before there's a valid waiver, it must be knowing and intelligent, and indeed you have a form that says the offender has to sign it, it has to date it, it has to be signed and dated also by a offender witness signature. And those are your own rules, right?
That's correct. That form specifically pertains to the first notice of hearing under 303.76, which is the Wolf due process rights. And again, in Bergman, this court specifically did not address whether the second notice was required for due process. So while the rule says, the language of the rule, the plain language of the rule says that for those rights, the inmate has to have voluntary and intelligent waiver.
Mm-hmm. But for the recognized right with regard to the notice of and time and place, it's the state position, the waiver can be unknowing and unintelligent.
That's correct. This court said as much in Sens, as I noted earlier. This court stated that waiver is effective even if it doesn't constitute voluntary and intelligent waiver. This court stated that the inmate only has to object in some intelligible manner and that no offer of proof is necessary. So there were no additional procedural burdens placed on Mr. Anderson by requiring him to object. If he felt that his ability to present a meaningful defense was in some way compromised by the department's error, he certainly could have raised this issue either at his disciplinary hearing or at his appeal to the warden.
If he knew about it.
If he knew about it, but he doesn't have to say the actual, he doesn't have to know the actual rule. He has to do is
Here's a staff advocate who's supposed to represent him, I take it. And he doesn't even know enough to raise an objection to the lack of notice. How can we expect Mr. Anderson to know enough if his own person that's representing him doesn't know that?
Well, I think the first point is that Mr. Anderson doesn't have to say, I object to my lack of second notice under 303.8179. He merely has to raise some intelligible objection.
Such as?
Such as standing up and saying my ability to present my defense has been compromised. I didn't have notice. My witnesses aren't here. Or something to that effect. And as to the role of the staff advocate, it's a very limited role. Under the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Wolf warned against the idea that the insertion of counsel into these disciplinary proceedings would give the proceedings a more adversarial cast, and they're not supposed to be that way. The advocate's role, according to 303.78 sub 2, is to help the inmate understand the charges, to help the inmate prepare and present their defense, to gather evidence and testimony, and to prepare the inmate's statement, and also to either speak for the inmate at the hearing or to help the inmate speak for him or herself.
Does this record reflect why notice was not given?
Why the second notice
was not given?
No.
So if the state did not produce any reason as to why they did not give notice, if we should hold for you, if we should rule with you, what incentive is there for the state to comply with their own rules in the future?
Well, I think that this rule has a valid purpose. As stated in the appendix note, it's to get everybody who's supposed to be at the hearing to be there. And that's in contrast to the first notice, which is to give the inmate time to prepare, as well as notice of the charges and notice of his due process rights under Wolf versus McDonald. So just for administrative reasons, in the prison, there's a purpose to having this written notice because it helps the...
If there's a purpose, then why don't they ever give it at Kettle Moraine?
Well, I don't know that they never give it at
Well,
Kettle
that's
Moraine.
Not part of the record?
It's not part of the record, no. But in this specific factual situation, the purpose of the rule was fulfilled because Mr. Anderson had all of his witnesses, he had his advocate, and he presented his defense. And the department complied with all the procedural due process requirements of Wolf versus McDonald. So the purpose of the rule was fulfilled, and the error was harmless under the harmless error provisions in the disciplinary code 303.87.
The state wants to hold this prisoner to the letter of the law and say to the prisoner, you didn't make the right noises, even if the noises don't have to be very much. Therefore, you're out. Why shouldn't the state be held to the same standard? I find that very difficult. Why should the state be excused from following its own rules? Just as a matter of course.
Well, I think first it's the idea of balancing the inmates' rights to get witnesses against the prison's interest in avoiding disruption and interference.
I'm balancing that there is a rule, and it's absolute. It doesn't say unless otherwise provided, and if it did, you haven't shown why it wasn't given. So why is that not the balance? That between a prison and between an institution of this state that has legal counsel in its own department and has legal counsel from the Attorney General's department, why shouldn't the state be held to the standard that it will obey its own rules or change its rules?
Well, again, I would say it's the flexibility idea. This is a prison context, and I don't think that we can say that they have to follow the letter of every rule when there's no harm to the inmate.
Why not?
Well, in this case, because the purpose of the rule was fulfilled, and Mr. Anderson...
It doesn't say in the rules, this notice shall be given unless the purposes shall not be, are otherwise fulfilled. It could say that. It could say we give them notice unless there's a good reason not to give notice. It doesn't say any of that. I mean, it just seems to me that it would be such an easy system that there's an automatic triggering of this second notice at an appropriate time. And it just should be a matter of form and process. This is our... You've got two instances of this defendant, this accused. Neither time was notice given, right? And you got two other cases where notice wasn't given. Since 91, I don't know how many other cases there are.
Well, I think, again, this is where a waiver comes into play. When we're looking at a procedural rule that is a mandatory rule, I think the inmate has an obligation to raise this issue at his hearings. If he wants to take advantage of these rules and he feels that his ability to present a defense was compromised, he has the ability to raise this and the duty to raise this at the hearing.
Is there a transcription made of this hearing?
No.
So we don't know if he raised it or not.
We don't know, but it's not disputed.
Counsel, if he would have stood up and said, my due process right is being violated, I never received notice of the hearing, and walked out. Let me, there is a transcript in the Sens case, apparently, because it's quoted in the Sens opinion. And there, in that case it was. And he said, my due process is being violated. I never received notice of the hearing. Walked out. Is it your argument that saying those words and walking out is not sufficient to constitute an objection?
Well, in Sens, the court concluded that Mr. Sens waived the error pertaining to the mandatory duty to present witness statements, not the notice provision. His objection, if that objection had been made in this case, I think that would have been enough to not be waiver. I think that would have been raising the objection in this case, and then the disciplinary hearing officer could have adjourned the hearing and rescheduled it still within the 21-day time period.
Well, we've spent an awful lot of time and effort, haven't we? A rule that seemingly is very easy to comply with. It almost seems to me, and just a comment, that this seems to be like a case where the parent is lecturing the child to not smoke cigarettes and meanwhile is puffing away. That the state is saying that it's certainly within its expectations and that inmates must obey the rules. But you sound to me like you're saying the state doesn't have to do the same thing.
Well, if my time's up, can I briefly respond?
Please,
I just wanted to say that I think
you've done a good job.
The waiver policy arguments go to that argument, that if the inmate wants to take advantage of this procedural rule that is for the ease and administration of the prison system, according to the appendix note, the inmate has the obligation to raise these issues at the administrative level because inmates have to exhaust their administrative remedies and because the department should be given the opportunity to correct their own errors. And in this case, because the error could have been resolved if Mr. Anderson had objected, his subsequent litigation was wasteful and interfered with the swift administration of justice. So I think waiver should be applied for those reasons.
Thank you, counsel.
Pardon me, I'm sorry. Just a process.
Was Mr. Anderson able to confer with his staff advocate?
Well, it's not specifically in the record, but for both conduct reports, there's evidence that he was able to request witnesses. And for one of the conduct reports, the one relating to group resistance and petitions, he had his own written statement, he had the statement of another inmate, and he had some question and answer forms from the sergeant who wrote the conduct report and the shift supervisor. So there's some indication in the record that he did have time to confer with his advocate.
Do you think Sains is distinguishable because it was a 1983 case?
I don't think it is. I think the policy considerations that this court addressed in Sens apply equally to certiorari cases. Specifically, the idea of speedy resolution of disputes and avoiding wasteful litigation. This court didn't address whether this rule was constitutional or rule-based. It just said that any error on the part of the department was waived when Mr. Sens walked out of his hearing without objecting.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Romanson, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. This could and should be a very simple case. This is a Bergman. Bergman controls this case. The court does not have to decide due process issues if it follows Bergman. It does not have to decide Sains issues of waiver as a matter of law. The court does not have to get into waiver as a matter of fact. The court does not have to decide. See, the problem, the point was raised that there's no transcript. I don't recall who raised it. Justice Babbage raised it, sure. The point was raised that there's no transcript in these proceedings, and that's true. How can we go back and decide whether there's waiver as a matter of fact? There's no transcript. This man is pulled from segregation. He's disoriented. He's isolated. There are all types of errors that occurred in this case, not just a failure of notice. There was no approval of witnesses before the notice was given. There's no signature by the hearing officer on the notice. All these things occurred. The administrative code is over 250 pages long. What you'd have to say on this record is, regardless of the fact that the administrative code is so long and complex to the point where the parties disagreed on it in Bergman, but a long and complex administrative code, a man who's disoriented and isolated, is brought into a hearing with never talked to his staff advocate about the merits, and he's supposed to realize all these rules and object to every one of them, or there's a waiver. That's not only that, but in order to hold that Sains applies, which the Court of Appeals apparently felt was appropriate because all fundamental errors are identical for purposes of waiver, this court would have to overrule Bergman, Brandt, probably Jones, and BJN. BJN specifically said that time limitations cannot be waived. BJN also, by the way, said that subject matter jurisdiction cannot be waived. In order to hold Sains applicable, because Sains said any error that's not brought up by the prisoner is waived, you'd have to overrule all those cases. You'd have to get into a debate on every case whether or not these inmates are sophisticated enough to realize whether these errors are so commonplace they should just be brought up in some intelligible manner, as the state says.
Was there anything substantively wrong with this hearing? Witnesses who weren't there that he wanted there, or statements or testimony that would otherwise have been produced?
That's the point. We don't know because there's no record. So you can never, in these inmate discipline proceedings, you can never tell if there's intelligent or knowing waiver because there's no transcript, there's no record. All you have is what basically is in the record here. You have evidence relied on for him. You have some statements by accusers, and you have a sheet that shows which witnesses were selected and whether they were approved or not.
Right, and I'm asking the question not so much on the waiver issue and whether there was a knowing and intelligent waiver, but on this idea of no harm, no foul, you know, harmless error kind of a thing. Was there anything wrong with this hearing that could be related to the absence of this notice?
Well, we don't know because, for instance, the witnesses were not approved until at the hearing. They're supposed to be approved before the notice issue. So he doesn't even know there's all kinds of things. He doesn't know what these witnesses are going to say. He's never talked to them. He doesn't know if he's selected the right witnesses. I mean, we just don't know on this record whether what kind of errors occurred. We do know that three errors occurred. We know that the department did not issue the notice that they're required to do, and which the state concedes on page 17 of their brief. Therefore, although the second notice of hearing under DOC 30381 sub 9 is a mandatory procedural requirement, the state concedes it's a mandatory requirement. That wasn't provided. They didn't approve the witnesses prior to the issuing of the notice, and the hearing officer didn't sign the notice like he was supposed to. So there's at least three substantive errors. If the court holds that there's waiver or that these errors should have been realized, then the court has to get into a determination in every case. How sophisticated does a prisoner have to be to know that these errors should be raised at the hearing?
Well, Mr. Wilmington, what is the practical result of holding in your favor? The discipline would be vacated.
Yes.
Well, you can't take him out of, he's been in segregation, can't give that back to him. 2 weeks without canteen, whatever the punishment was, discipline was, you can't give that back to him. So what does that do for him?
His record is expunged. He realizes that the department has to be held to their own rules, just like he does. When he picks up the administrative code and they say to him, you have to follow all these rules, he and all the other inmates in that prison know that the department also has to follow their rules. They know it's a fair system, and he's going to be treated equally, and he's going to have respect for the system.
Okay.
All the things that the department itself lists as their objectives.
Why can't they reinstate these discipline conduct charges and quote, try him again?
Because the time period for the hearing is expired. And see, that's very important. 30376 and the rules say that you have 21 days to conduct this hearing. Now the time period has expired. That's why they can't rectify or revive competency, because the time period has expired. Had the hearing officer, when Anderson showed up, had the hearing officer, as most judges in this state in civil context do, they look at the record and say, was this man given notice of this hearing? And if not, the department, in following their own rules, could have adjourned it within the 21 days and rectified it and still conducted the hearing within the 21 days. But they didn't do that. Now the time is gone. They can't revive it.
Well,
that's what EJN says, and that's what Jones says. Jones is specifically says that, Your Honor. The issue in Jones was, if the 21-day rule expires, does the department lose its competency to proceed? And that's what the court held. It said, yes, it does. That the department has to follow its own rules, and when it abandons those rules, it loses its competency. That's exactly what Jones says.
I don't know the Jones case, but did it involve the defendant the prisoner attempted to overthrow the disciplinary proceeding? It seems to me like in cases where in a criminal case the defendant appeals, you waive double jeopardy, you waive speedy trial, etc.
You can waive everything except subject matter jurisdiction.
Okay.
Now in Jones, the inmate did not object to the lack of the 21-day hearing, and there was no discussion in Jones of waiver at all.
That's State Expo Jones v. Franklin?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes our hearing in this second case. We will be in recess until 1:45, but the students and anyone else...